reading this evening continues our study in Paul's second epistle to the Corinthians. We read in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and from the first verse. Paul begins in the 8th chapter a quite different theme which he's going to develop in both 8 and 9. And now, brothers, we want you to know about the grace that God has given the Macedonian churches. Out of the most severe trial, their overflowing joy and their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. For I testify that they gave as much as they were able, and even beyond their ability, entirely on their own. They urgently pleaded with us for the privilege of sharing in the service to the saints. And they did not do as we expected, but they gave themselves first to the Lord, and then to us in keeping with God's will. So we urged Titus, since he had earlier made a beginning, to bring also to completion this act of grace on your part. But just as you excel in everything, in faith, in speech, in knowledge, in complete earnestness, and in your love for us, see that you also excel in this grace of giving. I am not commanding you, but I want to test the sincerity of your love by comparing it with the earnestness of others. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich. And here is my advice about what is best for you in this matter. Last year, you were the first not only to give, but also to have the desire to do so. Now finish the work, so that your eager willingness to do it may be matched by your completion of it according to your means. For if the willingness is there, the gift is acceptable according to what one has, not according to what one does not have. Our desire is not that others might be relieved while you are hard-pressed, but that there might be equality. At the present time, your plenty will supply what they need, so that in turn their plenty will supply what you need. Then there will be equality. As it is written, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little did not have too little. Amen, and may God add his blessing to this reading of his most holy word. And now turn, please, with me to the passage we read earlier in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. There are some things we are sometimes embarrassed to talk about in the church. Sometimes the cause of our embarrassment is due to the fact that what we have to say can so easily be misunderstood. Sometimes it's because that the issue that we are dealing with has been abused by others to the discredit of the gospel, and we don't want to continue in that vein. One of the criticisms of the 20th century church, perhaps one of the criticisms most frequently heard, is that the church is always looking for money. I'm sure you've heard that. The church is always looking for money. And I want you to notice this evening that Paul had no scruples at all about raising the issue of money. And he doesn't apologize for doing so. He doesn't see it as a dirty word, but as an integral part of our Christian stewardship. And as a result of that, he raises the subject with confident expectation in his heart. Paul was organizing a charitable fund to which he expected Christians everywhere to contribute. Now, he doesn't make it clear in this epistle what this fund was for. But it is assumed that it is the same fund that we find him writing about in Romans 15 and 25, where he describes there a collection that he is taking up for the poverty-stricken Christians in Jerusalem. The Jerusalem church had impoverished itself for the sake of others. You may remember that immediately after Pentecost, many of the Jerusalem believers sold their property so that they might have all things common. And part of the reason for their so doing was in order to provide for the extended stay of many Jews who had traveled considerable distance to come to Jerusalem for the feast of Pentecost. They had been converted. They had stayed on. They had lapped up the apostles' doctrine. But they hadn't brought enough spending money with them. And the Jerusalem church had impoverished itself for the sake of others. We also know that the Jerusalem church was experiencing, as indeed was the whole of Israel at this time, a very severe famine. And that had made life increasingly difficult for them. And Paul had promised that he was going to raise this matter with the Gentile churches. And he did so in the wealthy urban areas like that of Corinth. And we know that the Corinthians' initial response to this appeal had been encouraging. But that initial response had then begun to wane. And one wonders if perhaps the anti-Pauline faction that we know existed in Corinth had been at work, not wanting to support this apostle and this cause, surely. And Paul's concern now was that the much publicized Corinthian contribution to this fund might not in fact materialize. If you look at chapter 9, verses 2 and 3, he reads there, "For I know your eagerness to help, and I have been boasting about it to the Macedonians, telling them that since last year you and Achaia were ready to give, and your enthusiasm has stirred most of them to action. But I am sending the brothers in order that our boasting about you in this matter should not prove hollow, but that you may be ready as I said you would be." And it is for this reason that we have laid out in chapters 8 and 9 perhaps the most comprehensive instruction in all of the New Testament on Christian giving. And you will notice that Paul begins by reminding the Corinthians that the poorer Macedonian churches had been impressive in their response to his appeal. And the implication is clearly, you're surely not going to be outdone by your poorer country cousins in this matter. churches like Philippi and Thessalonica, far less wealthy than this thriving metropolis of Corinth. Now, you may well think that Paul here is bordering on some kind of emotional blackmail. But in actual fact, if wealthy Corinth could not raise more funds than these northern congregations, she did deserve to be humiliated, just surely as we deserve to be humiliated when we hear of the amazing generosity of many of the third world churches in Latin America or in Africa or India. And Paul cites here the example of their poorer cousins to provide, if you like, some moral leverage on the tight-fistedness of some of the wealthy Corinthians. Look at what Paul says of the Macedonian churches in chapter 8, verse 2 following. Out of the most severe trial, their overflowing joy and their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. For I testify that they gave as much as they were able, and even beyond their ability. Now, many of these believers up in the Macedonian province had suffered a great deal of persecution for their faith. Some of them were almost totally wiped out financially. We read that their poverty here was extreme. And yet, strangely, persecution had the effect of multiplying their liberality. Persecution, if you like, had the effect of clarifying their sense of values. And persecution does that. It causes us to focus not upon the material trappings of this life, but of the glory of the world to come. I was reminded recently at a conference that Pete and I attended that prior to his burning at the stake, one of the English reformers was shut up in prison. And at that time, there was no prison canteen, and the prisoners were responsible for buying in their own food. And the reformer in question was reasonably well off. He was able to purchase 2 meals a day. But he couldn't bear to eat both those meals by himself, while others around him in prison were hungry. And so one of those meals was given regularly to someone else in the prison. Persecution heightened his sense of values as far as the glory of the world to come was concerned. You see, as Christians, we can afford to be sacrificial in our giving, if for no other reason we really do recognize and believe that this world is not our home, but rather the world to come. Not only was the giving of the Macedonians sacrificial, you will notice that it was enthusiastic. Now, some people can moan and groan about the sacrifices which they make, but not the Macedonians. They didn't need to have their arms twisted entirely on their own, says Paul at the end of verse 3. I didn't come round and twist their arms. I didn't make a big appeal, an emotional appeal. I didn't refuse to let them out until they emptied their wallets. None of that. Entirely on their own, they spontaneously volunteered to give. And the word Paul uses in verse 4 of our passage implies, in fact, that they begged him to take their offering. And there's an amazing irony here when you think of it. These people begged, not for money to relieve their own poverty, but for the opportunity to relieve the poverty of others. In fact, the word translated opportunity is the Greek word charon, which is regularly translated as grace in the New Testament. Charis, grace. And they were pleading, you see, with the apostle for the undeserved privilege of helping others. You see, as far as they were concerned, if they were allowed to give, they would be the beneficiaries. Not the people they were giving to, but them. Here were people who actually believed what Jesus said, it's more blessed to give than to receive. They really believed that. And they begged for the opportunity, they begged for the privilege, they begged for the grace to be given them that they might give. Now their gift wasn't only marked by sacrifice and enthusiasm, it was marked by spirituality. Look at verse 5. And they did not do as we expected, but they gave themselves first to the Lord and then to us in keeping with God's will. First to the Lord. They weren't just giving for the needs of the Jerusalem church. They weren't just giving because Paul was a really nice guy and had done a lot to help them. They were giving, first of all, to the Lord. Paul is describing here not some automatic act of philanthropy. Here is a need, let me meet that need. The warmth of a personal consecration to Jesus is bound up indissolubly with their gift. They were saying, if you like, we're doing this for Jesus. They weren't behaving like accountants who were budgeting to see what was left in the reserves, but they were behaving with the irrational extravagance of a lover who doesn't look in his wallet to say, now, what can I afford on this bunch of flowers for this girl or whatever? It's that irrational extravagance that comes from a personal union, consecration. They didn't say, once we've bought all the things we want to buy, then we'll see how much we can afford. And so Paul says, this is how the Macedonians did it. Now, Corinth was a church with a reputation. And it had a reputation they were proud of. And Paul reminds them of that. In matters of faith and communication skills and gifts, in their comprehensive knowledge, in their earnestness, in their zeal. Yes, they had a name for themselves. Very well, says Paul. Let me see you excel in the grace of giving as well. Don't just talk about your commitment to God and to His Word. Put your money where your mouth is. Now, it is impossible, isn't it, to read these verses without being challenged by them. If the Macedonian example was used to prod other congregations in the first century, how much more should it prod the affluent Western churches of the 20th century? We can aspire to be good at so many things in the Christian life, but I would submit to you that too few of us have the ambition to be a better giver than we are. Dare we search our hearts and ask, how sacrificial is my giving? I recently read of a cow and a pig who were arguing about which of them was the more generous. And the cow pointed to the pints of milk which would be placed on the supermarket shelves during her life on the dairy farm. There, she said, beat that. And the pig pointed to a side of bacon and said, your milk represents a contribution, but what I give represents a sacrifice. Do we really miss what we give? When John Wesley was a young man, he discovered that he was able to live on £28 a year. We can't quite manage that today, but he discovered he could live on £28 a year. And as he got older, his salary grew in size. As he became better known in the Christian world, his writings brought him in thousands of pounds per annum. But all through his life, he continued to live on £28 a year. And the rest, he just gave away to those in need. He followed the Macedonian pattern. He gave sacrificially. And I'm sure all of us need from time to time to ask ourselves, what do I know of Macedonian generosity? But we also need to ask, how enthusiastic is our giving? Do we see giving simply in terms of our Christian duty? Or are we able to see it in terms of privilege? We say we believe God's word, but I wonder, are we practical atheists when we read it is more blessed to give than to receive? Does resentment rather than enthusiasm characterize our response when the offering bag comes round? Here we go again. Some Christians, it is said, give beyond their means. Some Christians give according to their means. And some according to their meanness. We need also to ask, how spiritual is our giving? When a humanist gives to help others in need, that is an act of charity. But when a Christian gives, That is an act of worship. It is an acknowledgement that all that we are and have is truly God's. We are responding to what God has done for us. That's why we've been singing the hymns we've been singing this evening. And that's why we'll finish with the hymn which carries the verse, "Were the whole realm of nature mine, that were an offering far too small. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my heart, my life, my all." In all that Paul had to say to the Corinthian church about giving, it is without, you will notice, coercion. Indeed, in verse 8, Paul makes it clear that he is not commanding them to give, and again in verse 10, that what he is offering them is advice concerning the manner of their giving. However, it is also clear that Paul believed that giving to the wider work of the church was to be seen as an expression of our Christian unity. Believers are not to see themselves as isolated individuals, but as those who have a mutual responsibility towards one another. The communion of the saints was for Paul a very, very practical doctrine. In chapter 8 and verse 4, and again in chapter 9 and verse 13, he uses the word koinonia, which is translated in the NIV as sharing, regularly translated as fellowship or communion elsewhere. And that is what the church is meant to be, a fellowship, a communion, a group of people who are glued together in a common life. And it's clear from Paul's use of the term in chapters 8 and 9 that Christian communion has quite definitely economic implications. Giving for Paul was not merely a private Christian virtue, but an expression of our corporate Christian unity. Verse 13 and 14 of chapter 8. "Our desire is not that others might be relieved while you are hard-pressed, but that there might be equality. At the present time, your plenty will supply what they need, so that in turn their plenty will supply what you need. Then there will be equality." Now, equality is one of these in words today. The Equal Opportunities Commission, I am told, has mushroomed in size and influence beyond the bounds of those who initially conceived it. We can no longer describe a job as a man's job or a woman's job, lest we offend members of the opposite sex who say, "We have been discriminated against. Let's go to the Equal Opportunities Commission." We therefore need to be clear about the kind of equality that Paul is speaking of here. He is not, for example, arguing for the redistribution of wealth so that the people in Corinth and the people in Jerusalem have precisely the same amount of money registered in their building society accounts. What he's asking for is a sharing of the Corinthian surplus in order to eliminate the deprivation in Jerusalem. It was an equality in the lack of basic human need that he was arguing for, and not for an equality in the absolute standard of living which they enjoyed. Paul is concerned, you see, with economic need rather than with economic diversity. You see, there is all the difference in the world between telling a man who has two shirts to give one to the man who has none, and in telling the man who has 10 shirts to give one of them to the man who has only 8. Paul is not suggesting that it is immoral for the Corinthians to have bigger bank balances than their brethren in Jerusalem. The Marxist philosophy, which aspires to the redistribution of wealth on the grounds that it is immoral for one man to possess more than is possessed by another, has no biblical basis to it. Though in the past some have tried to use passages such as this one to argue their case. The burden of Paul's heart is that there should be such a burden of mutual concern for one another within the church that we should seek to minister to and meet one another's needs. And you'll notice that it works both ways. He's saying to the Corinthians, you help the church in Jerusalem now. There may be a time coming when they will be in a position to help you. You could find yourselves impoverished. Armies could invade the whole of Achaia, where Corinth was situated. And then the churches in Jerusalem would be in a position to come to your aid and help. You see the picture that Paul is painting here. He is saying to be a Christian is to be a part of a worldwide family. Now in verse 15 we discover Paul reminding his readers of the provision of God for the Old Testament church in the wilderness. He who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little did not have too little. A reference to the collection of manna in the wilderness recorded in the book of Exodus. God fed his people with manna from heaven. Some people collected frugally. Others collected greedily of this provision. But when they got home and weighed what they collected, each family discovered that they had as much as they needed. And that, argued Paul, should be the model for the church's enjoyment of her wealth. God gives enough for everyone. But sometimes we have to do some mutual sharing to make sure that no one goes hungry. As far as Paul was concerned, the church should be a welfare church where we care for one another in need. And this we can do in a whole variety of ways within our immediate congregational life. Those who are better off can attempt to be sensitive to economic hardship which others may be experiencing. Are there some who genuinely find it hard to make ends meet? Some who have been out of work for a prolonged period of time? Some who are elderly? Some who are one-parent families and so on. Yes, I know the state does a great deal in these areas, and the state benefits scheme didn't exist in the first century. But you see what he's arguing for? Do you see the general principle? Sensitivity to the needs of others. Finding ways of expressing our fellowship with respect to their need without appearing paternalistic. Then there is the enormous challenge of the church overseas. You know, there are missionaries overseas who cannot engage in mission, the mission to which God has called them, because there simply isn't the resources to fulfill their God-given task. There are churches unable to afford pastors unable to erect church buildings in which to worship. And some are unable to afford food. Is Paul not making it clear in this passage that our surplus giving potential is for them? That is why God has given it to us. Do we not owe it to those who belong to the international family of God's people to share God's good gifts with them? This is the principle that's outlined in verses 11 to 14 of chapter 9. You will be made rich in every way so that you can be generous on every occasion, and through us your generosity will result in thanksgiving to God. The service that you perform is not only supplying the needs of God's people, but it is also overflowing in many expressions of thanks to God. Because of the service by which you have proved yourselves, man will praise God for the obedience that accompanies your confession of the gospel of Christ, and for your generosity in sharing with them and with everyone else. And in their prayers for you, their hearts will go out to you because of the surpassing grace God has given you. Giving is an act of service that fosters relationships. It certainly fosters relationships with the church overseas. Paul is saying people will thank God for you. They will pray for you as they have never prayed before, because they are praying out of a real heart involvement, because there is a fellowship link between you and them. And your giving has helped to establish that link. I wonder if we need to rethink our whole attitude to giving. Like many churches, we prepare a budget of anticipated expenditure for the coming year. We have a figure that we aim at, and we regulate our giving accordingly. If we're in the black, we've had a successful year. But we can become complacent, can we not? And say we are on target for our budget. Why should we give more? The minister is paid. The bills are paid. We've met our mission and aid target. Why should we give more? Surely the answer to that question is not found in saying for ourselves in this place, but for those we have fellowship with overseas, members of our family who are in desperate need. Last year, the Kirk Session decided to give to God's work overseas a small proportion of our annual income, with a view of increasing that percentage annually. And I want to ask, have we struggled financially as a result of that decision? No, we have not. Quite the reverse. God has blessed us in this last year. And I believe that God has honored that decision. But there's much more we could do. Why should we? There's the question. Why should we? Notice that Paul never makes a practical exhortation without providing us with the necessary motivation. And his principal motivation is not found at the beginning of the passage where he is saying, do not be put to shame by poorer congregations, but in the very heart of our passage, in verse 9, where he calls upon us to grasp something of the extraordinary generosity of Christ. He became poor so that you might become rich. Here are words which surely need to be branded on the walls of our minds and our hearts. Yes, and perhaps we should write them in our purses and our wallets and in our building society books. He became poor that you might become rich. For an answer to the question, why should I give sacrificially, enthusiastically, worshipfully, Paul says, look to Christ. He laid aside his majesty. He clothed himself with our humanity. He lived in this world. He suffered as a result of that. And that suffering found its climax on the cross, where he became our sin bearer, where he exhausted God's righteous wrath on our behalf. We were spiritual bankrupts. But now, we are spiritual millionaires. Why should we? Because he became poor, that we might become rich. You see what Paul is saying here? Our giving is our way of saying thank you to God for his inexpressible gift of his Son. May God seal his word.